Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. With us today, we have Brad Feld. Brad, you are the founder of Foundry, or co-founder, and you also co-founded Techstars. You have been, you know, a VC for 20 plus years. You are an author, a prolific blogger, and you are here on the back of having disappeared from public view for maybe 2 years almost, and now you're back with a book and you're back in action. So maybe tell us about the book and also tell us why you disappeared.
Well, I'll start with why I disappeared. And I referred to it as hibernating. And I expect I'll hibernate again probably in the fall or winter at some point. I about 2 years ago, I realized that I was very tired of all of the public activity that was going on in my world. And it was a much a different level. Some of it, I think, was just personal. Like, I was just tired of, you know, whatever, 20, 30 years of that sort of stuff. My wife, Amy Batchelor, and I are both inner hermits, and we love to, you know, just hermit out. And I just wasn't having a lot of that overall. Interestingly, I had stopped traveling for work, and my whole world had shifted to virtual post-COVID. But even then, I wasn't getting like enough distance from what was happening day by day, and I wasn't getting a lot of joy out of it. Second part of it, I was very busy with existing work and continued to be engaged with all the things I was doing, but I just didn't feel like there was space for any new thinking on my part. I was spending too much time reacting and constantly dealing with all this stuff that was going on sort of in this public sphere, and I was having trouble really working on and getting excited about exploring new ideas and some new thinking on my part. So I went into hibernation. And for me, what that really meant was turning the off switch on, shifting from what was for me default yes to everything. You know, I get an email, do you want to do this? Do you want to be a part of this? Do you want to respond to this? To default off, default no. So that kind of my natural reaction was not to say yes, but was to say no. And I had to think really hard to say yes and engage in something new that was outside what I was already doing.
I mean, you've been in the market for a long time. Did that coincide with kind of like the market pressure that all of startups basically faced over the back end of this cycle? And was that, did that kind of like, I don't know, make the all the public stuff feel harder or more tiring? Or was it like kind of independent of the market?
Well, it was a little before the market turned in some ways. So kind of, I was already, if you think about the comment I made of being kind of exhausted and this notion of shifting from default yes to default no, it happened probably mid-year, the year before the market started to really decline on the tech front. And I think some of it was the tone and the narrative in tech, which was this effusive, everything is awesome all the time. The phrase, we're going to change the world, has annoyed me for about as long as someone other than Steve Jobs has been saying it. And I was just tired of the shtick around it. The other thing that I really was noticing sort of in this time period that was starting to make me tired was more internal, which is and sort of less dealing with sort of the exogenous world. I'm about to turn 60. And so I've had this sort of steady sort of evolution from 55 to 60 as I've been thinking about what it means to be in the third third of life and what my values are around that, what's important to me, how I want to spend my time. COVID was a massive shock, you know, to everybody and the dynamics around reconfiguration of that. For me, pre-COVID, I traveled 75% of the time. I mean, I was very U.S.-centric travel, but I was all over the place all the time, almost every week. And then all of a sudden with COVID for, you know, a year and a half, 2 years, I got to be with my wife, Amy, every single day. And I didn't have to travel anymore. And the work reconfigured itself around remote. And as people started to come back to work, I didn't. And so that was also a little shift of how do I want to spend my time and where do I want to spend my energy? And I think that's really what the lead in to me deciding to hibernate was.
You see inside the companies that you're invested in, they've all kind of like struggled with that transition to remote and then back into, hey, how are we like all getting together again? And so in some ways, like maybe your response to it is like a capsule of what some of them have experienced. What do you think is like amongst your portfolio companies is kind of like the optimum kind of corporate philosophy to this moment across COVID?
Yeah, I don't think there is an optimum response. I think it's very, there's multiple different ways to do it and run a company. I'm not enthusiastic of the sort of everyone must be back in the office mantra. I think that's a certain cultural norm. What I encountered relatively early post-COVID, so as people were coming back, was that the cultural norms that the founders or the CEOs wanted to enforce were likely the effective dynamics. And I challenged a couple of the CEOs that I worked with who had a particular internal need to be in person all the time, or a desire, a joy of being remote all the time, to set aside their personal desire as they thought about what the right cultural norm was for the company. And I can give a couple of examples. I'm on the board of a company called Sphero. That's a fast-growing ed tech company in ed tech robotics. It's been around for a while. It's become a nice, strong, profitable business. It's one of the leaders. If you want to do anything with EdTech robotics, you would work with Sphero.com. Their customers are largely teachers, schools, school districts, and it's hardware and software. And the CEO of that company was a very much in-person kind of person. And the culture of that company was one that was very much in the office. And, you know, they adopted for COVID. People got 3D printers for their houses. You know, the engineers were able to do work remotely, and everybody sort of reconfigured how they had to work so it was effective. They consolidated their warehouse activity into a single warehouse in just outside of Dallas instead of with 3PLs that were in chaos because of all of the dislocation activity. And as things started to open up, the CEO, to his credit, sent a survey to the employees, kind of blind, and said, how many of you want to come back into the office? And the answer was like, you know, two. You know, it's like a tiny number of people in the company. And they worked really effectively. They were highly productive. And it was kind of a surprise. It was like, oh. And that didn't generate the answer to what they were going to do, but it generated the, like, let's think about this a little more deeply across the cultural norms that we have. One other example that happened in COVID that was totally mind-bending to me. I had never been on the board. I'd never been involved in a company that had a month of negative revenue. And I just want to be clear about that, where your revenue number was not zero. Your revenue number was a negative number. And COVID hits, the world shuts down. I'm on the board of a company called Rover, which was private at the time. It went public. They subsequently got bought by Blackstone and taken back private. And it was company was doing tremendously well. It was really strong, solid business, growing nicely, well-funded, lots of, you know, resources. Well, their two primary, their business, if people don't know Rover, is a dog walk, a dog sitting business, not a dog walking business, a dog sitting business. And their two primary reasons people use a dog sitting business is because you are at work all day and you need somebody to come over and spend time with your dog or take your dog out or feed your dog, or you're going on vacation or you're leaving or you're traveling or going, you suddenly have to go on a work trip and your dog's going to be alone. Well, if no one's leaving their houses, they don't need Rover. And what happened in this sort of fascinating moment, which I hadn't really contemplated ever, was not only did they have zero new business, they had to refund all the customers from the prior month that canceled. But we were also on the board of a company, or I was, one of my partners was involved in a company called SeatGeek that did ticketing. And exactly the same phenomena. We hadn't made the investment in SeatGeek yet. We were just familiar with it. We knew it. We were indirect investors through some funds that we were in LPs at. And SeatGeek, suddenly their business went a negative number. And we saw it, and we ended up leading a financing in a world where nobody else would lead a financing. But like these moments were like the dynamics. Everybody's looking for the uniform thing that is going to happen or the optimal approach. And the answer is, for me at least, generally, there isn't one. You have to go a level deeper.
Well, certainly when printing a negative revenue number, it would help to have somebody to turn to and be like, what do I do? You're a great mentor and you just wrote a book about the power of mentorship. Can you lay out kind of mentorship, how that relates to tech stars and why you wrote the book?
Sure. So the book that's coming out at the end of June is called Give First, and the subtitle is The Power of Mentorship. And it really goes through two primary things that I've learned from my experience over now almost 18 years of working with Techstars from the very beginning when we started it and all the companies that we funded. I think Techstars now funded over 4,000 companies around the world. But it also encapsulates what has evolved into my philosophy around work and business and kind of generally around life. So the philosophy that I refer to is now labeled Give First. Give First came out of a paragraph or two in a book I wrote in 2012 called Startup Communities. And prior to that book, the phrase startup communities didn't exist. I coined that phrase. And it really, my premise was that every city in the world should have a startup community to help as part of the engine of that city's health. Cities have to have lots of other things to be healthy long-term. But my view was that the innovation that comes from the creation of new companies was essential. And the idea of a startup community, just to link it to this notion of Give First, was that a startup community is different than an entrepreneurial ecosystem, or the phrases that everybody would talk about, innovation economy and academic shit that nobody really understood. And it wasn't accessible. And the essence was that the startup community is all about the founders. Its sole purpose is to help founders be successful. And that aligned with Techstars' core mission, which is to help founders succeed, right? But those sort of things co-evolved together as we figured them out. I had a paragraph in that book called Give Before You Get. Give Before You Get is a particularly ponderous hashtag. So, you know, in a tweet, if you do, you know, hashtag Give Before You Get. So somebody at Techstars eventually came up with hashtag Give First, and then that became the thing. But here's what it is and what that philosophy is. As an individual, you're willing to put energy into a system without knowing what you're going to get back from that system. It's not altruism. You expect to get something back, but you don't know what you're going to get back, over what time period, in what magnitude, in what consideration, and from whom. And so this idea of, as I started it with, building a startup community, if you want to generate a startup community in pick your city, You need to get a critical mass of people who are putting energy into the startup community without defining transactional relationships on the front end. I will do this if I get paid that. I will put this energy in if I get this out. Oh, I'll help you if you give me this, or I will help you if you sign this contract. And if you can build that into the cultural norm, all of a sudden you get a flywheel going, and very, very quickly, magic starts happening because things start emerging from that. I realized and sort of stepped back from that, and I realized that several of my key mentors when I was younger, when I was in my teens and 20s and even in my 30s, behaved that way with regard to me. The guy that bought my first company was a guy named Len Fassler, and Len had been a very successful founder of several companies. He had previously been a lawyer. And Len was the kind of guy that everyone loved and everyone followed. And part of the reason why was he was willing to just put energy into people before whatever the transactional thing was. And I had that experience with him. I had that experience with a few other people. My dad's brother, Charlie Feld, now he was my uncle. But I was sitting in meetings with him with technology companies like Lotus and Microsoft and DEC in, when I was in college that I had no business being in, that were opportunities for me to learn and engage and participate. And it wasn't just that he invited me to the meetings, but he let me participate in the meetings. And then he'd spend time with me after. And you could see this investment, but without really knowing where it was going to lead. And then in all of these cases, they led to some really amazing things. So this book, Give First, talks about these two things. One, this personal philosophy I have of this idea of give first as a way to engage in business, again, frankly, in life, in a non-transactional way. It's especially relevant right in this moment because so much of our world has shifted to transactional behavior. And there's sort of nothing wrong with it. There's plenty of transactional behavior that's very valid. But the idea of really impacting others through the combination of that and then this idea of how to be effective as a mentor versus just labeling things mentorship.
I guess to maybe flip it a bit as well, I'm curious if I was a 20-year-old looking for mentorship, is the best way to go to one of these already pre-established startup communities and try to connect there? Or what's the best way to find a mentor as a mentee?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question because I get asked all the time by people one of a couple of things that align with that. One question is, will you be my mentor? Right? And from somebody I've never met before. Not an effective starting point. Right? What I've come to is I think that there's multiple ways to develop relationships that then turn into mentor relationships. And I want to give you a language or a phrase that's really important in that context called peer mentorship. And rather than go on a long rant about it, I want you to prompt me for that. You know, hey, Brad, what is peer mentorship? To answer you, but hang on, let me answer the question of how do you find a mentor? The way you find a mentor really simply is you show up and you start doing shit. You engage with, if you're interested in being part of the startup community and you're brand new at what you're doing and you feel like, oh, I don't know anything. Well, that's not true. You know plenty of things. And by showing up and starting to engage in things that are interesting to you, and when I say engage, I don't mean be a passive receiver of it, but be an active contributor, not just questions, but also ideas and opinions. All of this stuff starts to build. If you see somebody who you want to engage with that's well-known or famous or experienced, or even maybe they're not well-known and experienced, but you look at them and you say, wow, that's a person that I think I could learn something from. The best way to start to engage with them is not to walk up to them and say, will you be my mentor? Or, you know, will you spend time with me? Or will you have coffee with me? And that's a particularly ineffective way to get someone's attention, especially if they're not naturally oriented towards that. The way to get their attention is to spend a little time and understand what they care about. Pretty easy in 2025 because of the web, you know, and everybody's online presence. Much harder when I was, you know, starting out in the mid and early 1980s, but still possible then. Just have to do more work. You have to sort of understand what that person cares about and then engage in some way with those things. Fred Wilson and I were, Fred Wilson at Union Square Ventures, well-known VC, and I were both very early VC bloggers. And we're good friends for a long time. And we riffed off each other, and his blog at avc.com and my blog at feld.com would often, you know, write about similar stuff. And we both had, you know, comments on our blogs. And this was well before Twitter and LinkedIn and other ways to sort of engage with people. And when somebody would say to me, how do I get Fred's attention? I would say, comment on his blogs. Like, he reads every comment, he responds to them. Just start commenting on his blogs. And Fred and I both have a very good friend who's now an extremely successful VC, a guy named Howard Lindzen. And Howard kind of took that to heart and just started commenting on our blogs. And it wasn't a pain in the ass, and it wasn't stupid. It was additive to our thought processes. And all of a sudden, that turned into a relationship, which all of a sudden turned into a friendship, and all of a sudden turned into dot, dot, dot. And so that can apply to mentorship very easily. Figure out what the person you want to get involved with is, and just start doing things that matter to them and you. It shouldn't be something that you don't care about. It should be something that overlaps in the universe of the two of you.
That the ability of startup ecosystems that you're describing to evolve is degraded by the fact that the cost of turning things into transactions has gotten lower and lower. As in everything, even you know, if I reply to somebody on X, right, that's actually, I could monetize that reply because I have, like, you know, I'm getting money for it. In some ways, like, even those interactions, the comments on blogs are now more of a currency than they've ever been. And so then there's like a, it's almost like it gets abstracted too early into dollars and cents. Or, like, do you feel that kind of in an intrinsic way in the stuff you're operating in? Or do you think that
it's kind of fun thing to play around with. So a couple things. One, and this is not a criticism of you, it's the effort to try to make the language right everywhere. There is no such thing as a startup ecosystem. Well, it's a startup community and an entrepreneurial ecosystem. And it's fascinating. That's been hard. That's, you know, that's been a hard thing to sort of get people to understand. And I wrote a second book about startup communities called The Startup Community Way that was inspired by Eric Ries's Lean Startup and then Lean Startup Way, in which I have a chapter that describes very clearly, like, the difference between a community and an ecosystem and why that language is important. And I say that tongue in cheek because it comes up all the time. I think, yes, to some extent, the immediacy of everything becoming transactionalized or money being, or some kind of currency being associated with everything, does create some challenges to this idea that I had of startup communities. But it's interesting because it does stand out in stark contrast. And I'll give two examples. Most recent example was my experience last week. So my wife and I live now primarily in Aspen, and in the winters we live in Tucson, and we spend the shoulder seasons in Boulder. We lived in Boulder for almost 30 years as our primary place. And so we come back to Boulder and spend, you know, a couple months a year in Boulder. And I was back, and it coincided. It was kind of coincidental, but then I was very happy about it. Last week was Boulder Startup Week. Now, Startup Week is a construct that has become a global phenomenon. It exists all over the world. Startup weeks are happening regularly. Some of them are called different things. Toronto is having Toronto Tech Week in a couple of weeks. And I'm going to go to Toronto Tech Week, you know, for a couple of days for a variety of reasons. But this notion of Startup Week started in Boulder in 2008, I think, 2007, 2008. That was the first place that it existed. It's one of the things that spun out of a lot of the activity that we're doing around the Boulder startup community. And if you think, so we had Boulder Startup Week last week, and I'm out of hibernation. I'm in Boulder. I went to the kickoff and was part of the kickoff event. And then I did a handful, half a dozen events during the week, and wandering around, saw tons of people. And a recurring theme at Boulder Startup Week was how powerful it was for everybody to get together and convene to build energy and connection around the startup community in person rather than just online. And I think so many of the transactional dynamics that you're describing, especially around, you know, tokenizing comments and tweets and things like that. I mean, yes, sure. I mean, you know, we have as a society, especially in the United States, there's a monetize everything you do kind of view of some people. But there's an awful lot of people, and again, go into the notion of give first. I've never charged for my blog. I've never charged for access to my, you know, current writing. I recognize that there's platforms now I could shift to, you know, Substack and have my audience have to pay a subscription for my magic thoughts. When I was a kid, I don't remember, Kiplinger maybe was a financial newsletter my mom got. She probably got a Morningstar newsletter, you know, a bunch of newsletters she paid for that were financial newsletters. And I know that's a whole industry. Like, it's totally fine. There's lots of industry around that. But the idea for me, if I look at my economic return of my life and all the business I've done, by providing my content for free and by allowing people to engage with me around the things I'm thinking about and that I care about in real time, the benefit I've gotten from that, by not having friction, by not having monetization of every last thing I've ever done, the payoff, the economic payoff is far greater than I think I could have ever expected. There's also one other piece of it that's really interesting. I have tried these things over time. I can't remember the name of the site. Ugh, I wish I remembered it. But there was a whole wave of sites. It was a little pre-mobile. It was Web 2.0, where if you were a celebrity or well-known, you could you sign up with a site, and they offered up your time for a certain amount of time for 30 minutes or an hour. And, you know, they took a rake, and I don't know what they took, 10% or something of it, and you kept the rest. And Mark Cuban's not a super close friend, but I like Mark a lot. And anytime we're together, we have fun, you know, publicly, which is most of what our engagements have been. And we both ended up on this thing. And I think he was like $5,000 an hour. And I'm like, yeah, fuck it. I'll do it for, I don't know, $1,000 an hour or something. And I remember doing it a few times. And like people that had no money that were starting out as the beginning of their startup experience were paying, you know, I don't remember, $250 to spend 15 minutes with me. And I did it like a couple of times, and it felt horrible. I mean, it was like, no, this isn't the right way to do this. So I had the experience also of that. And I think that built deeply into this value system, which is, look, there's a place that you can monetize your activity. And as a VC, I monetize it through investing. Oh, by the way, one last comment, somebody would say, well, Brad, why would you ever charge for a book? And the answer is, you know, writing a book is different than tweeting or Xing or whatever it's called. Like, it's a different effort and it's a different goal.
One comment that I have to get in at some point is Venture Deals was the first book I ever read in venture. And I feel like if anyone listening to this is thinking to themselves, they want to learn more about venture capital, they want to maybe kind of like get your very first break into venture and learn more. Couldn't recommend Venture Deals enough. It's the first book I read, and I feel like, you know, I owe some of my success to that book. That being said, I wanted to go back to the 15-minute spiel because you had mentioned also in this book that you do you'll block off one day a month, I want to say, where you just take 30 meetings in a day, 15 minutes back to back to back to back to back. And you found a lot of success and a lot of opportunities through that. Is that something you still do at all? Or?
Yeah, I did that. I call it random days. I did it for about a decade. I think actually I didn't make the linkage in my mind before, but I think the experience that I had of this, whatever that website was, probably was about the same time that I decided to start doing random days. So there's probably some linkage between the two. I was doing random days and I tried this website thing and it just grossed me out. Here was where random days came from. Your direct answer to do I do it anymore is not really. I went into hibernation. Although I'm doing one next week at a bookstore that Greeley Sachs runs and owns in Longmont, Colorado. Greeley's a very close friend, wife of one of my partners, Seth Levine, and she's redeveloping parts of downtown Longmont, which is the town over from Boulder. And you know, I have a book. She has a bookstore. So I'm going to go hang out in the bookstore and spend the day in the bookstore. And I'm going to do nine of these 15-minute random day meetings. And then I'm leaving 15 minutes in between open for whoever happens to be there. And I'm just going to hang out with them. But where it came from was, so I will do it periodically. I'm sure I'll do it some more during my unhibernation period. The driver for it was I try to respond to every email I get. And I've always tried to respond to all my emails. My email address is very easy to find. Plus, I give it out everywhere. My email address is brad@feld.com, right? So I just don't try to be, I try to be accessible. I was very visible in Boulder at some point because of everything that we were doing and all the efforts that I was involved in. And it got to the point where on a daily basis, I would get, you know, too many requests for let's get together for coffee, or can we do a phone call, or can we do this, or can we do that? And if I responded yes to all of them, as is my default yes way, all I do is sit in a coffee shop all day and have meetings with people. And of course, that didn't work. So I needed a construct where I could engage with people one-on-one, because that was what so many people wanted. I didn't want to be that inaccessible guy who, like, you know, oh yeah, Brad's really great, but no, you can't ever get to him. And so I started doing these meetings. I put up a calendar on the web. It was before there were, you know, good schedulers. So I had somebody help me hack something together so people could schedule. And I didn't do 30. I usually did 15 to 20. I kind of, by 20, I was completely fried and couldn't see straight. And I do these 15-minute meetings, and they would be back-to-back, usually in a public place so that you didn't have the office check-in friction. My assistant would sit there and, you know, people would sort of gather and hang out and talk to each other as they waited or whatever. I had a timer, and at the very beginning, I had a kitchen timer, you know, those little manual ones. And I eventually shifted to a phone. And I would say, okay, 15 minutes, the next 15 minutes belong to you. Go. And I covered whatever the person wanted to. Over time, what I realized was at the end of these days, I was starting to feel a little frustrated with myself, because a lot of the meetings would be the person just asking me for something or trying to get something out of the meeting. Some of them really didn't go anywhere, or I didn't know how to help the person. So I decided to make two goals for every meeting for me. Goal number one was to learn one thing. And goal number two was to make one connection or help the person with one thing. And so I began really focusing that on that as part of the 15 minutes. And, you know, I wrote about it on my blog. And so people would know, like, they'd come to the meetings a little more prepared than, hi, it's nice to meet you. It was really incredible how much impact that had on me because of what I could learn and experience and how much that impacted others. There's a long list of things that came out of those random day meetings that were transformative, really productive for me. One of them, which I talk about the story in the book, is Techstars. I met David Cohen on a random day meeting. I didn't know him before that. And the initial funding for Techstars came out of that first meeting that he had with me. And by the end of that 15 minutes, we were ready to go experiment with what has turned into this global phenomenon.
And Techstars, I'm not sure how familiar every single person is. Maybe might be worth giving a little background, but you know, a lot of people debate still to this day, like, which came first? Was it YC or Techstars? And you guys kind of spun up around the same time without even knowing that either of you were doing it. Is that correct?
Well, not really. YC definitely came first. And the way that Techstars emerged was David, before he met me, had sent, I believe he sent Paul Graham a note saying, hey, I want to do something like this in Boulder where I live. And I don't remember what Paul's response was. David shared it with me at some point, but it was probably something like, you know, like, go away, leave me alone. Like, you know, if you want to do something like that, sure, whatever. Not, you know, kind of not helpful and dismissive in the context of, you know, it's my thing, not your thing, and I don't want to help. What happened, there was not another accelerator, and YC was nascent at the time. I think they'd run one or maybe two programs in Boston and maybe a program in the Bay Area. I can't remember. And what we did was we started Techstars in 2006 and ran our first program in the summer of 2007 in Boulder. And I think a construct that was different about Techstars was that we effectively started it with the idea of engaging the whole startup community. We didn't know what a startup community was at the time, but that was the language we would use today. And we essentially created the idea of a mentor-driven accelerator versus, you know, some investment-only accelerator. By the way, the word accelerator didn't exist either. David attributes that to, Cohen attributes that to me. I have no idea if I was actually the person that came up with the word accelerator, but he does attribute it to me. And as we're trying to describe what we're doing, we wanted to accelerate these companies, hence accelerator. And we wanted to be mentor-driven, not guru-driven. Guru-driven was, I know the answer to how to do this, so therefore, here's how you should do it. And mentor-driven was, what we did was we got 50 people that were experienced entrepreneurs, a handful of VCs, a handful of people from service providers like law firms that were very involved in entrepreneurial stuff. And we had them be mentors for that first program. We didn't really know how to define what a mentor was at that point, so it took us a while to kind of get the mentor thing right. And early on, the joke about the mentors from some of the folks, with they were all FOBs. And if you remember what FOB was when Clinton was president, you know, they were friends of Bill's. And in this case, they were friends of Brad's. Like, I don't remember who coined that. But, you know, just 50 people that I reached out to. And most were from Boulder and Denver, but some were from the West Coast, from the Bay Area and L.A. Some were from the East Coast, a couple from Boston, a couple from New York. And they would come to Boulder and they would spend a day or two with the program, with the founders, and I'd hang out with them and spend time, and we'd have dinner with smaller groups of them. The locals, we pretty quickly got people working with one or two companies pretty intensively. But I would say most mentors, you know, continue to engage across all of the companies. At the first demo day that we had for that first program, part of what all the mentors, of course, came, but a bunch of other people from the community came. And I got up, and as part of my intro, I said, you know, y'all can do one thing. You've been mentors all program long. It's been great. You can do one thing that profoundly helps these companies right now. And it's to write an angel check of any amount, $5,000, $10,000, $25,000. Like, this was back in a time when $25,000 was a pretty big angel investment. And, you know, companies raising $500K in 2007 was a big deal. And it was interesting, like, we built in Techstars early on this notion of, again, what turned out into Give First, which is these mentors gave energy well before they invested. And it was interesting to sort of have the realization. I think many of them are like, oh, I know exactly which company I want to invest in. You know, I don't have to sit through 10 pitches to decide that. I know, because I've been working with them for 90 days, and these are the ones I want to keep working with. So that's where Techstars started. And, you know, it evolved into, you know, what it is today, which is, you know, a global organization that makes, you know, a lot of investments a year in programs all around the world in startups. But fundamentally, we have three goals. Everything we do, our goal is to help founders be successful. And yes, we're the earliest investors in those companies, but as the earliest investors in those companies, we're trying to continue to do whatever we can to help them succeed. Early on, we had this sort of notion when we started to expand into other geographies that startups and entrepreneurship should happen everywhere. And for me, my phrase, not a Techstars phrase, but my phrase became that I was very involved in the global democratization of entrepreneurship. And Techstars was at the core of where I put that energy, you know, sort of in a business sense. So Techstars was part of that. But there are many other organizations that I've been involved in that have helped with that. And of course, the whole philosophy around startup communities. And today, you know, with David Cohen leading Techstars, the real internal mantra around what we're trying to do, in addition to, you know, the key goal that we have is for founders to be successful and for us to help founders succeed, is that better is better, not bigger is better. We went through our own growth cycle as an organization and started funding many more companies in many more places. And over the last couple of years, really realized, especially with the shift in the way entrepreneurship is happening today and companies are being created, that our goal shouldn't be to maximize the number of companies that we're funding every year. It should be really concentrate on bringing the most we can to the companies we fund and funding the best entrepreneurs we can find that fit the characteristics we're looking for at the very earliest stages.
It seems like there's, or I would assume it's actually harder to seed and start a startup community than it is to kind of like invest in and accelerate a startup community that's already kind of like operating and working. You know, I think about kind of like going to random town and being like, okay, everybody's startup community. Like that seems like a lot of work that maybe pays off down the road, but it's more like identifying that and then putting capital into it. Is that part of like, I mean, one, is that true? And then how do you think about that? Like, it just seems like a real challenge.
Absolutely true. And it's something that I have a lot, you know, I've had a lot of experience with and have written a lot about, but also engaged with a lot of different geographies that have, you know, started, you know, really from scratch with a startup community and have evolved them. I was smiling because Techstars has fundamentally, two fundamentally new products this year that are now rolling out in different places and are starting to be implemented. One of them is something we call a startup community partnership, and it addresses specifically this issue. David came back as CEO of Techstars last summer. And when he came back, we spent a lot of time. He'd been chair, but he hadn't been running it day in and day out for about 3 years. When he came back as CEO, he and I sat with David Brown, who was one of the other co-founders. The fourth co-founder of Techstars was Jared Polis, who's now governor of Colorado. And we sat and talked about sort of the strategy, and it became apparent quickly to both David Cohen and I, that creating a startup and the dynamics around creating a startup, of which Techstars had enormous experience with, because we've helped, you know, 4,000 plus companies in their initial stages, were very similar in some ways to the characteristics around getting a startup community going. And there's a lot of startup communities all around the world that exist, but are really nascent or early in their journey or stalled or having trouble really getting traction against the backdrop of characteristics in the broader entrepreneurial ecosystem that's holding them back. And you know, let me try to make it more tangible. If you think about the startup community as the center of it, where the goal of the startup community is to help founders be successful, I now sound like I'm saying taglines, so I'll try to get out of taglineville. The entrepreneurial ecosystem is the thing that's all of the actors, all of the different participants that are helping those entrepreneurs be successful in the startup community. So they participate in the startup community, but they aren't the core essential value of what's being created. And examples would be universities, large companies, service providers, government. These are all actors in the entrepreneurial ecosystem. But if you separate the organizations from the people, from the individuals, one of my first principle, I have a thing I call the Boulder thesis that I came out with in 2012 that's well known among anybody that does something with anything with startup communities. And the first principle of the Boulder thesis is that entrepreneurs have to be the leaders of the startup community. Basically, the founders have to lead, not the university controls the startup community or government is responsible for the startup community. Those are all, I categorize those as feeders. I made a mistake in the first book, and it was very funny and generated a lot of amusing conversations. It was not intended to be one up, one down. Feeders are really important to the health and development of the startup community, but they can't lead it. However, people who work for feeders can be leaders of the startup community. So somebody who works for a big company who's responsible for all the activity with startups, maybe across the country or across a region, can actually be a leader in their local startup community. Somebody who works for city or state government that wants to engage with the startup community can play a leadership role as an individual. So I categorized them as instigators. And I say now that the leaders of the startup community have to be founders and instigators, and the feeders are the organizations helping develop and grow the startup community. And the collection of all of that stuff, you know, emerges into the entrepreneurial ecosystem. Now, in that, one of the things that we've been doing at TechStars for 18 years with startups is surrounding them with mentors. And, you know, here's my advertisement for my book, Give First, right? Give First is about the power of mentorship. And I spend a lot of the book really deconstructing effective mentorship and talking about what effective mentorship is and how it can work. And I use 18 items from something that David created in 2010 called the TechStars Mentor Manifesto. And I don't just sort of play back the Mentor Manifesto. I do the same thing I did with venture deals. Chase, talk about venture deals. I had blogged all of the aspects of a term sheet on Feld.com in 2004, 2005, and 2006. And that became the essence of the book Venture Deals, which came out in 2010. But the blogs were like 10% of the book. And I didn't just take the blogs and stick them in the book. I rewrote all of them, right? But I sort of used that as the way to get me started on writing the book. And the same thing here. Like I used the TechStars Mentor Manifesto. And if you go to Feld.com, I have a blog post about each of the items, sort of trying to describe it and deconstruct it a little bit. And I didn't take the blog posts and just copy them, but that was kind of the seed corn for me to say, okay, I've got a starting point to putting this together in a book. We're now applying that at TechStars to startup communities. So in the startup community partnerships, we're running cohorts. We're running the first one starting in a couple of months of communities and people in communities that want to not necessarily start from scratch a startup community, but maybe have something, but want to get it to the next level. And we're surrounding them with programmatic activity, the same way we do with the accelerator, communication with their peers. So they're part of a cohort of people in other geographies all around the world, working together to figure out how to grow and develop their startup community, and mentors who are successful leaders of other scaled, you know, and large startup communities around the world that are connected in. So like that same model is very powerful in terms of linking these things together. And I think it's something y'all understand as an investor group very well, but I'll sort of take it to a word we haven't used at all, which is network. Like the essence of all of this stuff is that building a self-reinforcing positive feedback, positive sum network, not zero sum where there's a winner and a loser, but positive sum. You know, the economic language for that from 30 years ago in complexity theory was increasing returns. And you can't have infinite increasing returns, but a positive feedback loop in a network where the network, it continues to grow and evolve, and each actor is a node on that network. In fact, the power of the node grows and the node increases in size, not by some arbitrary thing, but by the number, and not by the number of things you're connected to, but the number of things you're connected to times the value across each link in the node. So if you have an incredibly large network and you do nothing with it.
Yeah, it's not worth much. I mean, and also just like drawing back to the idea of like basically giving first without predefining the option value that you're going to extract or anything like that. Really, to me, philosophically, what that allows a network to do is links to strengthen without kind of like transactional friction on that strengthening, right? And so you want to like grow the connections that make sense and work without freighting them with like a lot of kind of like friction before growing. And so that seems like that's almost the core of why it matters that you do it without an upfront kind of like ask.
Really nice tie back and completely true. And use the right word, which is friction. You know, the way you get a positive feedback loop moving and really moving is to lower friction or to try to eliminate friction. And when you put gatekeepers in the way, you know, to make something happen, you have to go through this. Or when you put money in the way, oh, to be able to have access to this, you need this. That creates friction and it slows things down. If you believe that if you can get a positive feedback loop really moving and in the way of getting it really moving, there will be ways to generate economic returns downstream. And using the construct of give first, it's not altruism. You expect to get something back from it. You just don't know when or whom or what, you know, what magnitude or what consideration. Like, it's going to come from different places. And, you know, somebody who's being skeptical or pushes back on that will say, well, yeah, but if you try to start a company and you don't ever charge for anything, you just try to build as much traffic as you can, you know, what you'll end up with is you'll end up with, I don't know, something like, you know, Google or Facebook, where at some point you just monetize it with some, oh, wait a second, right? So, you know, yes, not a new idea, but maybe a little bit clearer and crisper in some of these things. Of course, you know, there's monetization characteristics in business all the time, but where are the best places to put those as you're trying to create something from scratch?
So speaking of friction and steering the wheel just a little bit. You actually, I think it was yesterday, on May 19th, you posted that you read every doc or you page through every document. And I was thinking, and one, it's kind of like, in order to do a deal, having to look through the entire legal doc seems like, you know, some friction. And also kind of, we have these wonderful tools that are available to us to like use AI to, hey, it could summarize the doc for me and kind of write the emails for me. There's all kinds of ways in which you could be kind of force amplified in a sort of generic way with AI right now. How do you think your relationship with the companies you work with and with the kind of companies you invest in is going to change as a result of kind of like this acceleration in tooling and AI, or will it? I mean, it necessarily will, but like, how are you thinking about kind of the leverage points there?
Well, for sure it will, and for sure it does. And you know, the Turn Every Page blog post that you're referring to, you know, really came from two lines. It was a story reflecting a line that I heard. The line that I heard was somebody was at the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting, and Warren Buffett said, gave a rant about Turn Every Page. And, you know, he's famous for, of course, reading, you know, being an amazing investor, but reading every SEC filing and like finding the gems of what he wanted to do from sort of deep study. And, you know, the guy that bought my first company, Len Fassler, who I mentioned earlier, is an incredible mentor of mine and extraordinarily close friend, passed a few years ago. The story I tell is of learning how to actually read legal documents, sitting next to Len in the mid-90s as we did an acquisition together for a new company we'd started, and where he literally turned every page. So it sort of made me remember that, and I play back to that. And, you know, I think it's a metaphor. It's not an absolute statement. I mean, I for sure don't read every word on every page of every legal document of every deal I'm involved in. But the concept, when you're seeing, you know, you figure out what's important to make sure you're reading, and you read it and you understand it, or you at least skim it and make sure you see it. One of the things that I wrote, which is happening all the time, is the number of DocuSigns, you know, that I get sent to sign that just don't have anything.
They don't have a document.
There are no documents. So, it's like, here, yeah. I'm the signature page. What the fuck am I signing? Like, what? Yeah. It's got a little footnote at the bottom. Like, well, you're signing to this. I'm like, no, time out. Like, you know, I actually want it to relate to something. But the interesting thing about your question on AI, to take it in that direction, and I pose this as a rhetorical question to some degree. How many of you have asked, you know, whether it's Claude or ChatGPT or Gemini, a question about something that was, you know, fairly complicated and got the wrong answer, or asked it about something that was happening and it gave you an old answer? And then you had to ask it a different question to get the answer you wanted. Here's an example. That's a fun example. I was listening to REM's It's the End of the World as You Know It. You know, I'm almost 60. So of course, you know, bands like REM, are in my mainstay. My wife says I live on a steady diet of, Pink Floyd and Rush, just to age myself. And, I thought, I'll go to OpenAI and I'll just ask it, you know, to write a contemporary version of this. Like, you know, hey, can you write a version of this, you know, with today's environment? And it wrote one, and it was like old stuff. I said something about with the current Trump administration, and it wrote one. I'm like, this is all old stuff. This is all stuff from old Trump. And I asked it, is this, you know, from the prior administration, you know, which time frame was this from? Oh, this was from, you know, 2016 to 2020. And it was okay, but it wasn't like what was going on in the last 100 days. And I said, well, I want now. Well, I can't do that. My thing times out till this. And I said, can you search the web to get more blah, blah, blah? And it said, oh, yes, I can. Yeah, yes, I can search the web to do that. And then it made me a version of that. I just use it as an example. Like, of course, this stuff's going to get better. It's getting better very fast, but it's important to understand what it's really good at and what it's not, and where the boundaries are. And there's a lot of argument right now, especially in terms of regulatory environment, around whether AI is something fundamentally different or is it software. And, you know, I think that from the hype cycle perspective, of course, everybody wants to talk about it as something fundamentally different. And also from the regulatory environment, I think there's a lot of people that like to say, oh, there's this new thing. But it's actually quite useful. And for me, as somebody who's been through, you know, too many hype cycles since I started my first company in the mid-80s, it really is software. And so this idea of understanding where it's going to impact you and your business's best is powerful and important. There are two places today, probably when people listen to this podcast, in companies where it's unambiguous that the path we're on with AI today, which, by the way, for most people, if you want to simplify it, it's predict the next word. Right? I mean, that's kind of the technology. Now, there's a bunch of other stuff going on, but we're coming from that frame of reference. It is going to completely transform the way software development works. It already is. And it's going to completely transform the way automated interactions work. And a classic example of automated interactions with any technology product, or frankly, any product, is customer support. Will that transform the way the legal industry works? Well, probably should, because there's an awful lot of document creation that is not really requires any sort of intellectual processing. It just requires putting out information, or the inverse of it, which is summarizing what this gigantic, ponderous thing that you can't barely read says and distilling it to what's important. I remember when Copilot first, Microsoft branded it Copilot and started talking about it's going to be part of Office. I wasn't blogging then, so I was mostly just writing long emails to people I knew to get rid of that part of my energy, including like our CEO listed Foundry or the living group that I lived with in college. They had to put up with like long emails for me about stuff like this. And I said, gee, this is really cool. Copilot's awesome. What I can do now is I can give it three bullet points and say, make me a PowerPoint presentation from these three bullet points. And then I can take the PowerPoint presentation and I can say, distill this down to three bullet points. Isn't that an awesome use of compute? And so productive for society. So, I say it tongue in cheek, but there's a lot of that going on right now in this part of the hype cycle. And nobody's going to listen to me saying pay attention to it, but it'll be interesting to see how it evolves. But there's no question that it's rapidly changing the way we work.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I think changing how software development works, which is unambiguously a thing that's happening, there's a lot that can happen downstream of that that could really transform the world. As in, like, all of my problems with technology are basically software problems. Like, even my problem with the iOS ecosystem and everything else, it's like poor integration. And so being able to effectively generate custom software for me on the fly to stitch things together, which is not yet possible, but is on the come.
Actually, I would challenge that. I think it is possible. So I wrote software commercially till 1992. And then since then, I haven't written any commercial software. Every couple of years, I learn a language. So, I fool around. I know Python modestly well. And I would joke that the reason I write books is because the language doesn't change and the tools don't change. It's English and it's a word processor. I guess it changed. I eventually started using Google Docs instead of Word to mostly write my books. And then my publishers would use Word, so I'd have to go back to Word, but they're close enough. Writing software, like I could learn how to write silly little things in Python, but I couldn't do anything because I couldn't get deep enough in the language. I didn't know the current tooling. It was too hard for me to use. Yeah, I could kind of like mess around with GitHub, but to really like actually understand how to use it in a productive way, it was going to take some time. Deploying to the cloud, whatever that means, and figuring out how to get that set up so it was actually workable and possible, right? Over Christmas, I decided to, start playing around with this thing I'd been hearing about called Cursor that all of a sudden people were talking about how it was a cool new way to develop software. Vibe coding hadn't been a phrase yet. I think it's a magnificent phrase. But I was sort of playing around with it a couple months before, and I'm like, I had some time over the holidays because, the world slows down a lot. And so I download Cursor. And I'm like, all right, I know Python, so let me mess around with Python for a little while. And I actually ended up building a very simple little app that downloaded or synchronized with Strava and Whoop. And all of a sudden, I had my Strava and Whoop data in a single app that I could play around with. I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. I'm like, I want to do something that's like, to turn that into something useful is going to be a lot of work. And so I said, let me make a video game. Let me see if I can make a video game. And I don't know JavaScript. I've never programmed anything in it. I mean, I've looked at it, the code, but I don't know it. And so I ended up, probably took about 40 hours total with Cursor, JavaScript, and Vercel, which is the backend hosting environment, and GitHub in the middle. We're about 20 hours of the 40, I would say, was going up a learning curve on tooling. I wrote a game that's on the web. You can play it if you want. It's called dinostroids.com. It blew my mind. Like, it totally blew my mind. Now, there were a lot of problems, and I had to, like, tune the AI to do stuff, and I had to learn how to do better prompts. And, of course, Cursor was evolving very rapidly, so it was getting better. But then, like, so I had to, that's why I say about half of it was learning curve. Yeah, I think today in, summer of 2025, you could sit down with a tool like this with relatively little learning curve and actually start doing things that are productive. And there is no question that, right now there's too much to choose from. So understanding what's effective for different use cases is still pretty hard. The technology is for sure, the efficacy of the technology is there.
Well, Brad, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I look forward to the book comes out on June 2nd, I think, perhaps. But you can pre-order now.
Yep. Pre-order. Amazon pre-orders are up. And as anybody who knows how to game the system, game the system's the wrong word. Anybody who knows how to interact with the feedback loops that exist in Amazon, the pre-orders are actually productive and useful. So if you're interested in the topic, pre-order now.
Well, really enjoyed having you on the show, and welcome back to the world. I'm you know, thrilled that you're back, you know, at least presenting yourself publicly rather than writing long emails to friends only. So
I think my friends are probably glad to get that energy on the web instead of to them. Thanks for having me, and congrats on a great podcast with lots of interesting folks. I appreciate you being interested in at least hearing me blather for a little while.
All right, great. Cheers.
Thanks, Brad.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button and make sure to leave a comment down below letting us know what you thought. And if you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe to the show. And follow us at ARK Invest on your favorite social platforms so you stay up to date whenever we drop a new episode.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.